Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America, where each episode we bring you a new interview with one of the film industry's top directors, conducted by one of their peers. You can now subscribe to our podcast on Google Play Music, as well as iTunes, Stitcher, or on our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/thedirectorscut. This episode takes us behind the scenes of director Colin Hanks' documentary film about Tower Records, All Things Must Pass. From its humble beginnings in a small-town drugstore in 1960, Tower Records grew to become a powerful force in the music industry. By 1999, company sales equaled $1 billion, but 7 years later it filed for bankruptcy. The question of what went right and ultimately wrong is examined in the documentary, which follows the company's trajectory and the legacy forged by its rebellious founder, Russ Solomon. The screening was a part of the DGA Special Projects Committee's documentary series. After the film, Mr. Hanks spoke with Special Projects Committee's chair, Jeremy Kagan, about the obstacles he encountered in the making of All Things Must Pass. Listen on for highlights from their conversation, including the challenges of selecting music for a film about one of the music industry's most iconic stores, and the immense amount of footage collected for the film. One part in particular was recovered from a dumpster. Enjoy.
Actually, I'm going to start with the Kickstarter.
Yeah, sure.
How did you decide to, and what was your experience with Kickstarter?
It ended up being a lifesaver for us. We had gone out in 2008 to go speak with Russ and to sort of get his agreement to be involved. And I had driven by on a lark. I went to go drive by the Watt Avenue store just to see what was there, you know, some sort of news store, I imagined. And I saw that the sign was still up and all of the racks were still in there. And so we threw together what we could to shoot, and we shot the interview with Russ in the store, along with Paul Brown and another man by the name of Dick Harris. And with that footage, we went out and tried to find financing right when the economy had gone into the gutter. And pretty much everyone we went to said, look, no one's going to care about a company that went bankrupt 2 years ago when all of Western civilization is about to lose everything. And so the film sat around for probably a good 2 years, and then Kickstarter came around. And I discovered Kickstarter, and it seemed like an interesting way to do it. And that combined with cheaper camera technology, I sort of said, well, this is sort of like our last shot. And because so many people had told us, look, we don't think anyone really cares, it was a way for us to not only raise a little extra funding so we can at least keep making the movie, but then we had a whole list of people. We said, see, these people care. I mean, they care enough to be able to put money down now, you know, just on the idea of it. And so it really ended up becoming sort of the lifesaver for the film and a life.
How much did you ask for?
God, I don't remember how much we asked for. 50,000, and we raised 90.
Off of 50.
And at the time,
that's impressive.
At the time, that was probably one of the most highly funded documentaries at Kickstarter. I mean, now people are raising millions of dollars on Kickstarter. Yeah.
So what's on the editing room floor?
Quite a bit of stuff, actually. I mean, we shot so many terabytes of footage. One of the stories that we fought very hard to do, we realized throughout the course of the 7 years that we made it, is everybody has their own Tower Records story, and they're all great, and I never tire hearing about them, but very often those stories are great anecdotes, but they don't really help push a narrative. And so we really had to be very, very hard-edged in terms of what actually made it into the film. And there's one section that is actually only about maybe a minute 30 long. But in San Francisco, they did an in-store promotion. This is all on the extras. They did an in-store promotion for the band's Music from Big Pink. And one of the executives, I think from Capitol, came up with the idea of spray painting an elephant pink and writing it into the store. And so they did it. This is a long time ago. And there was this whole like back and forth between Stan and Russ, because Stan was adamant that the elephant had relieved itself inside the store, and Russ was adamant that it was outside of the store. And so then we got them on camera together to try and solve the mystery. And Russ said, no, it was outside the store. I know, because I was the one that was giving it all the champagne. So they basically spray painted an elephant pink and got it drunk. So that's on the cutting room floor.
Learning about, the, you know, part of the documentary experience is not really knowing what you're going to get.
Yeah.
What were your surprises?
You know, when we started off, really, I was looking sort of in a much more retrospective mode in terms of they opened these stores in these locations during this year and this time. And it was really sort of very much looking back and it's sort of almost clinical, you know. They opened up the San Francisco store right after the Summer of Love, right after that town's been invaded by all of these dirty hippies. And there was sort of this sort of tinge to it. But it wasn't until we started interviewing people and Russ had introduced us to what we call the generals, the Stan Gomans, the Mark Vitasiches, the Heidi Kotlers, that we really realized what that what the personal journey was. You know, some of it was really trial and error. Like the more we got to know these people and really like them and like the stories that they told, we slowly started to realize that we had a narrative here where you meet these people, you fall in love with these people, and then you feel their pain when they're forced to fire each other. So that heart, that sort of tower heart, which I had a hunch was there, I just didn't really know. That didn't really come around until we were, you know, pretty deep in the interview process. And then at that point then, we had really started to find our film. Then it was really just a question of, okay, well, what have we shot? Because we filmed interviews for 6 years, but I didn't see any of the footage until our final year.
Because?
Because we didn't have the money to pay an editor to go through all the footage. So basically, I threw terabytes of footage at our editor's feet, Darren Roberts, incredibly talented editor, and said, all right, here's my idea. Here's the arc. Let me know if this is possible. And he spent, weeks sort of putting it together. And then when I finally saw a radio cut, which didn't have any B-roll, didn't have any, you know, videos, didn't have any photographs, but it was just the people telling their story, that's when I knew that we had something there. But I had given him two rules. I said, I don't want a narrator, A, and I don't want a group of famous people in the first 3 minutes telling you why Tower Records was important. I'm declaring that it's important because I'm making this film. So let's have these people be our narrators and tell their story.
In the graphic imagery that's here, the evolution of it I'm interested in, because the way you showed stills by sort of like showing the still and therefore left and right is empty space, mm-hmm. but you've got these little markings and also the sort of just the graphics that are there in terms mm-hmm. of where the place was, the maps that were used. How did that all evolve for you?
That was all about trying to do something different. I had noticed, you know, in the years that I'd been making this, I watched pretty much every rock documentary that had been released. And I noticed that there was a sort of pattern of stuff. Narrators, famous people at the very beginning, and then these sort of 3D animated pictures to help bring stuff to life. And I think those are incredibly great tools to help tell a story, to help bring it to life. But I wanted something different. I wanted to see something different. And I pulled a page out of the Russ Solomon playbook. And we know Sean Stewart, my producer, who's here. We brought on this guy, Eric Del Greco, to do sort of our graphics pass. And I said, all right, dude, have at it. Like, show me what, you know, like, what do you want to do here? Like, show me stuff, and we'll go from there. So he had sort of come up with the idea. The only sort of thing that I had mentioned to him, there was a documentary that Scorsese did about George Harrison called Living in the Material World. And he had done this one, I think it's only really in one specific shot, but he had filmed a photograph. I mean, he actually filmed a photograph laying on a table, and you think it's a still photo, and then someone comes in and flips it over, and then there's handwriting on the back. And I thought that that was an interesting way of being able to add motion to a still photograph, but have that picture tell a story. And I think I must have mentioned that to Del Greco at some point, and I think Eric sort of picked up on that and sort of came up with the idea of, you know, being able to come up with a template or a lens, because we have these sort of like headers, these markers on a lot of them. And we wanted to be able to, you know, again, just try and show something different, show something that hadn't been done in any doc that we had seen. And that was one that really, really jumped out and spoke to me.
With the fall of this particular company, did you already have an attitude about, I'm going to say this, the way capitalism works, or did you learn something in the process?
Oh, I learned everything in the process, to be quite honest. I mean, the amount that I learned from Russ Solomon, not only how to run a ship, you know, and to trust in people, you know, to not micromanage. The way that this film was made was purely out of the Russ Solomon playbook. Surround yourself with smart people and then get out of the way. You know, don't micromanage, because I don't know any better. This is the first time that I've ever really directed anything. The first time that I've shepherded something from a germ of an idea to a finished product. So who am I to say I know what to do? I just know what I want the story to be. But I really was sort of as hands-off as you can and sort of surrounded myself with smart people and let them work. And then we talk about ideas and refine them and make them work. And, you know, Russ's whole mentality, you know, the fact that I had this man, when I went to meet Russ the first time, I did not know what kind of person I was going to meet. I was under the impression that I was going to go meet a very important CEO type guy who was going to be like, hey, kid, what are you doing? And, you know, Russ shows up with, you know, khakis and a polo and is like, you guys are crazy. You're not going to make any money. But yeah, sure, let's do it. Let's give it a shot. And that really impressed me. And the fact that while we were interviewing him, he would admit we had no idea what we were doing. And I said, I know exactly how that feels.
But let's talk about still the issue of where it went, because there's the issue of sort of driving something that you truly believe in, investing all your energy, having the attitude that he did, which was surround yourself, as you just did, with really talented people. It rose. It became popular. It fit the zeitgeist at various times.
Yeah.
And then it hit, it's a big business.
Mm-hmm.
And then we watch the demise. Mm-hmm. And what I'm interested in, and we see this and we experience it, but I'm asking for you, what did you learn about this process? If you were now to run a business, or if Russ were to do it again, what you've learned that would prevent that demise? And it seems to me there's something about the nature of capitalism, the system of economics we live in.
Well, you can't get comfy. You know, that's the main thing. You always have to have your, you know, one eye on the road and one eye, you know, a mile away, you know, a mile ahead of you. I think one of the things that really pops out to me is this concept that the company always made money from 1960 all the way to 2000. They always made money every year. So you can't blame anyone for getting a little comfortable. You know, when you see just growth that entire time, you almost can't blame them for doing that. At the same time, you know, they got away from what they started. You know, they got away from their original roots. You know, they build that sunset store for cheap.
Right.
But then at the end, they're building 8-story mega stores that cost millions of dollars, you know. You get away from yourself a little bit. So just because you're getting that success, you got to make sure that you hold on to those roots. And Russ is always really adamant about trying to think about what the company was going to do in the future. But he was also dead set in, you know, certain things that he wasn't willing to do. He wasn't willing to sell used merchandise. There's not a record store in the world that is still around that didn't start selling used merchandise as soon as they possibly could. That's the thing that has kept record stores alive. Is selling used CDs. And so it's this delicate balance, you know, it's this hard thing. I mean, one of the things very early on that I tapped into very quickly was that Tower was the first for so many different things. It was one of the first retail chains that broke boundaries and would do things differently, like advertise records on the side of the building, and you know, create this sort of concept of like, oh, all the new music is coming out on Tuesday, so let's, you know, make Tuesday a special thing. They did all of these first, you know, so that regardless of the fact that they were always consistently kind of finding themselves in the right place at the right time with the right attitude from a historical standpoint, they were always sort of trying to blaze trails. And that starts at the very beginning of the music retail business when Russ starts selling used, you know, 78s out of his father's drugstore. But I also knew that they were viewed, especially when we started the film, as the first casualty of the music industry. They were the first big record store to close, where everyone said, oh, things are really desperately going to change, and very, very quickly. And that was one of the things that we really wanted to analyze a little bit, because we didn't want to get too bogged down in the weeds of where the music is going and streaming and all that sort of stuff, because it changed dramatically throughout the course of us making it. We knew we'd never be able to keep up. As soon as we said something, we knew that it was going to change within a year. So what we wanted to do was be able to give people a better understanding as to why Tower left and sort of pop the bubble to this notion that it was quite simply just the internet that killed Tower, because it wasn't. It was part of it for sure, but it was also hubris on Russ's side, the fact that the company got too big and they couldn't move as quickly as they once did, but also the fact that the entire record industry propped themselves up on CDs decades before. And that was the, you know, as Mike Ferracci says, they really planted the seeds of their own demise right then and there.
When you were doing these interviews, there's a wonderful moment when I think it's John Urey, I don't know if it's his last name, and he breaks.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea that was going to happen?
No idea at all.
And how did you handle it?
Gingerly. you know, it's never a comfortable thing to see a grown man cry, especially when you're not prepared for it. We knew that we needed an outside perspective.
Right.
And so there was one trip that we had sort of put together where we interviewed both Steve Knopper and Jim Urey. And I wanted someone that was not from the Tower family or close to the Tower family, but was familiar, that could speak about Tower specifically, but then also at the record industry at large. That's where Steve Knopper came into play. But we would hear all these stories from Russ and from Patty and Stan and all these people. And there's, you know, the Tower family, but then there's the extended family, or as I like to call them, like the drunk cousins. And those are the people that worked on the label side. And we sort of said it would be nice if we could get someone from that label side that was part of the Tower family, but not directly connected. And so they put us in contact with Jim. And we were just interviewing him, just talking to him. And we had sort of boilerplate questions that we would ask everybody. Mm-hmm. And we would just talk about, you know, tell us who Russ is. Like, if you had to explain the kind of person Russ was to someone who had never met him before, how would you describe him? What's something that Russ did for you that sort of exemplifies the kind of character he is? And he started telling that story. And at that stage in the interviews, I had been trying to keep track of about 4 years worth of interviews without having seen any of the footage. And so we actually brought on a writer, Stephen Leckhart, who's a journalist by trade. And so he would do the interviews face to face, and he would spend time, you know, talking with the people and getting them comfortable while I was busy trying to set up frames and do all the other stuff. And then I would sit behind Stephen and I would try to put the puzzle together during the interviews. And so I could listen to what Jim or any of the other people were saying, and then I'd know, oh, I want to explore this. And it was just one step removed for me, so I had that safety to be able to do that.
Did you do most of the interviews that way?
We did probably about half of them that way, not all of them.
Did you do Russ that way?
We did one interview with Russ that way, and we did two others. I handled two others.
When you would be in the midst of that, and if you had an idea, would you lean forward and say?
I wouldn't lean forward. I would write a little post-it note and I'd hand it to Stephen. And we would have discussions as to where we would want the interviews to go. And so whenever we touched on something, I would write out a little post note, slip it to Stephen, and then he'd ask them to elaborate on that or whatever. So I was sitting behind Stephen, and I had my head down, and I was just sort of keeping the minutes, so to speak. Because, again, I had no I hadn't seen any of the footage that we had shot. So I needed some sort of reference as to what's in these interviews. And I had my head down and all of a sudden I hear this pause. And all of a sudden I hear him breaking up and I look up and Jim Urey's crying. And I had no idea what to do. And Stephen asked another two questions after. You know, we let him collect himself. We let him tell that story. And we asked two questions after that that were almost sort of gimmies. I mean, he really needed some time to sort of collect himself. But yeah, you never really prepared for that. But that was, there's, I can say this at the DGA because you guys will get this. But I remember, I don't remember where I saw this, but I remember seeing a documentary about The Last Picture Show. Now, I'm going to admit something here. I've never seen the whole film. Sorry. I will.
We won't tell Bogdanovich.
Yeah, but I remember a documentary in which Bogdanovich was shooting a scene with somebody. Again, I don't know who it was. And the scene starts and there's some cloud cover. And then in the middle of the scene, the clouds dissipate and it gets brighter in the middle of this monologue. And then the cloud cover comes back and then it gets dark again at the end. And during the take, the DP is like looking at him going, "Can't use this." And Peter's like, "Just keep going." And it ends up becoming a very important moment. And I remember seeing a similar moment like that in a pretty big scene in Breaking Bad, like a big vista shot where it does a very similar thing. And I remember thinking, just let things go, let it happen. And by the way, it is a documentary, so we got to capture moments as they happen.
Yes, you know, one of the things that I often am in conversation with other directors about is the role that the unanticipated, or in quotes, accident plays in the work. And this works in terms of drama just as much as it works in terms of the documentary. And to be able to actually adjust and flow with it is, in fact, part of your job.
Well, it's part of it. And also, I knew that one of the biggest knocks about the film is that we did not have a verite element, really. This is a Talking Heads documentary. And by the way, a Talking Heads documentary that at that time was almost primarily dominated by old white men. And so I needed to make sure that the people that we are talking to were people that you felt sympathy for, that you felt something for, and whatever happens in those interviews is what happens in those interviews. And Russ was very specific with every one of them. You tell your version of the story. Don't worry about, you know, pissing, you know, Russ told them all, don't worry about pissing me off. And they would never piss Russ off anyways. But he told them all, these are the guys, tell them everything. You go.
That's the issue of, since our culture has a tough time dealing with elders, mm-hmm. The issue of knowing that all the people, or most of the people you're going to talk to, are in fact our elders. Mm-hmm. And, what's this going to do to my audience? Mm-hmm. You're like, a bunch of old people uninterested. How did you deal with it? If you deal with it at all?
We didn't really have to deal with it. I mean, we knew that there were some going to be challenges because we were going to have to, you know, in the back of our minds, we said, it's going to be a big screen. How close up do we get? You know, those kinds of things. But we knew that we'd have B-roll. We knew that we'd have, you know, a substantial sort of library of images that we would use to be able to cover over as much as we could. And that became obviously very handy as we started to, like, truncate sound bites and sort of get things moving at a quicker pace. But really, the biggest issue was, I said, there's got to be a woman voice. There has to be a female voice in this. There has to be. And so we told Russ and Patty, said, who's the one woman that we talked to? And they said, Heidi Kotler. That's who you talk to. And Heidi was amazing. I mean, she was, you know.
Where was she at the time?
She lives in the Bay Area now. So she drove out to Sacramento for one of our shoots and was, you know, more vulgar than all of the other guys put together. Which I love about her. And she was able to put things in we were able to get that extra perspective, you know, that I thought was really vital. And she was so truthful, to be quite honest, that we actually had to sort of like reel back just a little bit. Because there's one point where she said, you know, when she's talking about going into labor, you know, no women stuff going into labor behind the counter and all that stuff. There was another line where she said, I had to keep up with these asshole men. And knowing Heidi, we laughed. We thought that was really funny. But we were also sort of like, well, she's calling all the other guys assholes. Like, I don't want to taint the rest of the guys just for Heidi. But we were able to find ways to be able to sort of slip that in so that people sort of understood what her challenges were.
With the amount of material that you had, the terabyte plus.
Yeah. 16 terabytes total, Sean?
Whoa. Was there a point in which, when you watched the first edited version, you say, uh-oh?
No. I'll be quite honest. When I first had the radio cut, I felt such an immense relief in that.
And how long was it?
About that. Well, we're at about a 90-minute running time. We probably trimmed about 20 minutes out. Yeah, so there was a lot there. I to be quite honest, I just felt such a huge sense of relief knowing that we at least had the audio portion of the film together. And then it was really just about cutting it down and refining it. And again, pulling a page from the Russ's playbook and just trying to make it as efficient and as good as we could.
Choosing music, how did you decide what?
That was a big thing. That was actually probably one of the biggest roadblocks that we came up with very early on, because we didn't know any better, but we would go out saying, yeah, we want to make a Tower Records documentary, and everyone said, like, we're not going to pay for that soundtrack. We're not going to pay for the licensing on that. It was a very specific thing. I told Darren, our editor, I said, look, I don't want to tell you specific songs. I think I maybe only told him two specific songs that I wanted to use, one being All Things Must Pass, and then the other one being California Soul by Marlena Shaw. Those were the only two that I specifically wanted. But I wanted music that did two things. I wanted to make sure that each track that we had in checked two boxes. One would be that it fit the era in which we are examining at that moment, but it also needed to come from a specific aisle of a Tower Records. So I tried to include as many different kinds of genre of music as we possibly could, to the point where I was trying to fight for a song. I was trying to fight for a song from the soundtrack aisle that would have been a song that was used in like one of the Ocean's 11, 12, 13 movies. Like I tried to get one of those songs in the movie. I'm like, no, it's from the soundtrack aisle. Like, we got to have it. And that was actually something that Darren Roberts, our editor, sort of picked up on. So from the very beginning all the way till the end, it's genre specific from the aisle. It's era specific, the time we're in, all the way up till the closing song, which is a song by Benjamin Booker.
The one about the death of Tower? No,
not the one about the death of Tower. That's a whole nother cool story. But the one like right at the top of the closing credits, the dum 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 dum. That was selected because that is the kind of record that a Tower employee would have turned you on to.
Got it.
Here's a cool new kid from New Orleans. He's 24 years old. He's an amazing guitar player, Benjamin Booker, Violent Shiver. Here, listen to that. The Tower Records is gone. That actually came through Kickstarter. At some point, I just asked, we emailed all of the Kickstarter people saying, if you have any photos, you have anything, send it in. Maybe it'll be in the movie. And this guy sent in that song that he had recorded. He had written it and recorded it.
What year had he recorded? I mean,
That must have been 2006 when the stores were closing.
Right.
And I said, well, that's a closing credit song if I've ever heard one. That'll be a fun one.
When did you discover Elton John? Actually, personally, when did you discover Elton John? And then how did you discover
him? I'll admit something else. I'm not actually a big Elton John fan. My parents never listened to him, so I never really got a proper introduction. Obviously, I know what an immense talent that man is, and I know how important he is in the scope of music. The Elton John, so there are two interesting things about the Elton John thing. The story that Stan Gohman tells about opening up the store early for Elton, that was one of the first stories that Stan had told us very early on, the day that we first met him. So I knew that that would be an engaging part of the doc, maybe if we could sort of do it. And I knew that there was a famous quote that he had given in which he had said, if I had to do it all over again, the job that I would plug for the most would be a job at Tower Records. And so I sort of put it on us. I said, okay, well, if we're going to be the definitive Tower Records documentary, and I want I wanted the famous celebrities to help push our narrative forward. I wanted them to be able to not just tell us the tower was important, but actually be a part of the story. Well, the fact that he would show up at that tower sunset, that ended up being a big thing. And the fact that he started, you know, going and shopping at Tower Records, that ended up being a big part of, you know, what made Tower special. And so we reached out to him and spent a lot of time going back and forth in terms of getting the dates and sort of how we were going to sort of orchestrate it. But he was very keen to talk with us. He spoke with us for probably maybe about 30 minutes before one of his shows at Staples Center. And some of the stuff that's on the cutting room floor, there's a quote that he gave us on camera where he said straight up, he said, "Yeah, shopping at Tower Records was better than sex." I'm like, how do we not put this in the movie? But he's got that great line about him spending more money at Tower Records than any other human being. And I
didn't know the footage of him when he was buying. Was that his?
So here's the craziest. That is the craziest story of everything that we got. Everything that we got, for the most part, was given to us by former Tower employees. There was some stuff that we had found online, but that was mostly like Pathé footage of like San Francisco and stuff like that. A couple of things from Sunset. That footage we discovered online. Someone, we don't know who filmed it. We're assuming it was someone from Tower because they probably did it for some sort of promotional use. But the man who owns that footage now found it in a dumpster. We don't know why he was in that dumpster. We didn't ask. But he was going through a dumpster and found that footage, and someone had thrown it out. I mean, at some point, you know, I mean, maybe when VHS became popular, I don't know, but someone threw the film canister out, and he found it and held on to it, and he's the owner of it now, and we had the pleasure of paying him for it.
But how did you find him, or he found you?
We found him because he had actually put it up online.
Okay.
He had put it up online.
Do you know, and it's in the movie to some degree, but that yellow, that red on yellow is Tower Records.
Iconic.
And I can't remember, I saw, you know, you see the design of it, but did they have any idea how powerful that really was?
No. There's actually a very interesting, we would notice all of these sort of circular sort of beautiful sort of touches of life sort of coming back around. And, you know, Mick Mickelson obviously was a very smart graphic designer and sort of was very, you know, really helped birth Tower Records in terms of giving it that iconic signage and coming up with that letter and doing all that stuff. And the fact that he basically just lifted it from shell gasoline is pretty funny. But there, you know, there's no way that you could know that it would be that iconic. Right. But it ended up being that sort of thing. And when people see, you know, the bags in Japan, like we have a bunch of bags in you know, at our office, and you know, there's collectibles now online, and people see that stuff, you get super excited. But there's the thing that's really beautiful in the building that you see at the end where they give sort of Russ the standing ovation. That's the Tower Records headquarters, which is separate from all of the store locations. Directly across the street from that building is a Shell gas station. And I remember just sort of looking at that and seeing the orange, you know, the ketchup and mustard, and just sort of going like, wow, yeah, there's no way that you can sort of guess that stuff. And again, that's just, you know, when I think of that, I just think of Russ saying, I'll be honest with you, we have no idea what we were doing, but we did it anyway.
And when Russ saw the movie, what was his review?
We sent him the documentary. I was driving home.
By the way, did you go through, do I send it to him or do I go?
No, we knew we were going to send it. We had to send it to him.
No, but the question is, do I go with it as distinguished from let him see it on his own?
I don't remember if we had really any of those conversations. He lives up in Sacramento, so we sort of figured like it would be good for him to see it. And I think maybe in self-preservation, like maybe we just send it because if he hates it, I don't want to be there. it's a nerve-wracking thing when you're showing a film about the person that's you know, that's there, and it's them talking. It's a little bit different when you're like wearing makeup and you're like, "Yeah, I kind of look like you, right?" But he called me up, and
how long between this? This is always,
yeah.
This is a director's anxiety moment.
Yeah,
that's what I'm wondering. How long between I send it to him and he called?
He called me as soon as he had watched it. like the moment he, we sent it to him, and then I think he maybe saw it like within a day.
Wow.
I don't, to be quite honest, I don't, it's a blur. But he says, well, I just watched the movie, and I go, hold on 1 second, Russ, and I pulled the car over. I pulled the car over and said, well, and I'll never forget it. He just said, well, my boy, you've done it. That's it. That's our story. That's the way it was. And, you know, when Russ calls me, when he says to me, my boy, that means a great deal to me.
That's great. Well, you may have never gotten a job there, but you now have the job there.
Yeah, no. I applied twice.
Now, because this is an audience that actually loves this, let's you guys have some questions, please ask them away.
Yeah, you got to take us to dinner before we tell you how much the movie costs. It costs more than the 90 grand that we raised on Kickstarter. I'll say that much. The music costs more than that. Well, no, actually. The interesting thing that happened with the music was I'm very fortunate in that I know Olivia Harrison, have met her on occasions. I actually was lucky enough to meet George at one point. And so she was one of the first people that I went to. When we did the Kickstarter, I said, I want to name the film after George's album, and here's why. And I gave her this sort of backstory. So she gave me the blessing to call the film All Things Must Pass. And then a couple of years later, I sent her a cut of the film that had, you know, all of the temp music that we wanted to use, and basically all of our selects. And I said, here's the film. And obviously this is me asking you, can I use the music? And she said, yes, you can. She watched the movie twice in a weekend and said, yes, absolutely. And because we had her signature and therefore the Harrison estate, and we were able to get that at a very reasonable, friendly rate, we could then say to the Beach Boys, hey, you know what George Harrison's estate's charging us? And we did that for pretty much everybody. I learned a lot about the music licensing. It's difficult. It's hard. I learned how not to request, to use people's tracks. Like, here's how much we're paying. Here's what the movie's about. Can we? And we'd all get no. And then I reached out to probably four or five artists on Twitter, ironically, to which they would sign off and say yes. The most difficult one was the Rolling Stones because of their publishing deal. On Sticky Fingers, their publishing deal is very complicated.
And when you made your request on Twitter, how long? You don't have a lot of...
I would... It was sort of a little bit of a long con where I would reach out to them and sort of say hello, and then I'd say, and then I'd get them to follow me. And then I would DM them, can I have your email? I want to ask you a question about a Tower Records documentary that I'm doing. And then
I'm counting that, that's two.
Yeah, and then sometimes the DMs would be like four or five messages in a row. And then I would send a detailed email with the clip of the film that has their music in it so they could see it. And pretty much everyone at that point signed off yes. And then the only tricky thing was the Stones, because I had to get the publisher to agree at the price, which was their big thing. They were like, no. But then I also had to say, like, look, I'm not trying to use the riff from Brown Sugar. I'm trying to use the instrumental portion from Can't You Hear Me Knocking, and I'm using it as score. So I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not just throwing it in there. There's like a point, and I would give my whole big spiel, and they said, okay, yeah, you could do it. But now you got to go get the Stones approval. And at that point, I had 24 hours before we had to lock our sound mix. And so, long story long, I got in touch with the Rolling Stones in 24 hours.
That's very impressive.
Yeah.
Did you go through festival rights first in music and then full?
Yeah, we did festival. Yeah, we did festival rights first, and then once we had been we had that going on, then we
other questions. Down that road. Yes, please, and really loud.
That was our wish list moment. That was the one that I was hoping if we could scrounge together enough money, and if we could get our act together and quite honestly, I'll be very honest with you, finish the film with Russ still around, I would love to be able to bring him to Japan. I would like to be able to deliver that for Russ and help facilitate that for Russ, because I thought that it would be an important thing for him to experience. And after we had burned through all of our Kickstarter funds and we had shot a pretty significant portion of the movie, we then went out for another round of fundraising, because fundraising is never done with documentary films. And we got enough to be able to finish off a majority of the interviews with Bruce, Elton, maybe one or two other interviews, and then do that trip to Japan. That to me, it just felt like that was if I'm going to take an audience on a journey, that's what you want to see. You want to see Russ walk back into a Tower Records store.
And that's an evolutionary thing. You didn't know that the 6 years when you were starting, or 8 years when you were starting, that you were going to say, okay, how am I going to end this movie?
No, but I knew that they still existed there. Right. And so I knew that that was a pipe dream.
Okay.
I knew that that could be on the table, but that really there was quite a bit that was going to need to happen in order to help facilitate that.
Where did you shoot Bruce?
Bruce was done, that interview was done at a venue that's, it doesn't have a name. It's on Fairfax. It's called, it's nicknamed No Name, but it's where the old Largo was on Fairfax across from Canner's, and a buddy of mine owns it. So I said, hey, I got to film an interview with Bruce Springsteen. Do you mind if we use your space? And he said, yeah, sure.
And was Bruce in for a concert?
No, Bruce was in town for personal reasons. And he came up. I was talking earlier about boilerplate questions. For a majority of the interviews, the last question we would ask everybody was, if you had to explain to a 13-year-old who's never walked into a record store, how would you describe a Tower Records? And the amount of sound bites that we got from that question, they're almost all in the movie. And it ended up being a great way to sort of end the interview as the experience in person, in real time, but then it also brought us the most fruitful, thoughtful answers that we could. So Bruce shows up for the interview, and he says straight off the bat, he says, like, I'll be honest with you, I don't really have many Tower record stories. And I sort of joked, I said, well, I only need one, Bruce. And he goes, all right, well, you know, we'll give it a shot. And I said, honestly, you know, if I ask you a question and you feel like you have no answer for it, just say so. You don't have to, like, come up with something for me. So we're sitting down to do the interviews. I don't have Steven with me, so it's just me. And I'm like, all right, so he's thinking I don't have a Tower Records story. How am I going to start this? And all of the other interviews were like, okay, so could you introduce yourself and what do you do? Like, I'm not going to have Bruce Springsteen do that. So I asked him that first. Bruce talked for 15 minutes. Everything that is in the movie was answered in those first 15, in that first question. And then the rest of the seven other questions were just throwaways. I didn't need anything else. He gave me everything in that first answer.
I can't resist. This is the last question. If you had to explain to a 13-year-old what's it like to go into Tower Records other than your movie,
yeah,
what would you say?
Tower Records was the place where it didn't matter what you looked like, it didn't matter what you sounded like, it didn't matter what your interests were. It was a place that you were always welcome, the doors were almost always open, and they didn't care if you bought something. So it is an open invitation, 365 days a year, to discover yourself. That's what it was for me. Growing up, that was a place that I could hang out and I could meet other people. I could learn about music. You know, that thing, what Russ says, like, about kids and when they lost an entire generation of kids even coming into a store. That was a special thing. I didn't grow up in the vinyl era. I grew up in the CD and cassette singles era. But the exact same thing, those same tenants of Tower that were at the beginning were there, you know, for my era too. So it was a place where I knew, all right, I got no money, but I got tons of time. What do I do? You know, how do I fill up my night? How do I fill up my day? And so I got, you know, that gateway drug. They just said, come on in. And that was it. And as I got older and I moved out of Sacramento, it didn't matter where I was in the world. If I was doing a movie or a play in London and I'd see, oh, Tower Records, that's an evening right there. And if I'm there for longer than, you know, a couple of days, if I'm there for 5 weeks, all right, well, Tuesday nights, that's where I'm going to go because I don't have to buy anything. You know, it's a bar where they don't, it's a bar that is all ages, but they don't care if you buy something to drink. You know, they may even let you use the bathroom without buying something. That's really revolutionary because even Starbucks will make you buy a water.
Well, you have given us a lot to drink from this movie. Oh, thank you for making such a really delicious movie for us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you all very much.
Thanks for listening to this DGA Q&A. You can watch more discussions like this on our website or our YouTube channel. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to The Director's Cut on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, or our SoundCloud page so you won't miss an episode. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for listening and have a great week. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America. Music is by Dan Wallian.